It's Let's Talk Legal this afternoon with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. As we begin the program, just to remind you, you have the opportunity to talk to them by phone or by technical benefits of digital technology at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. Or you can give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050. 726-9050, and I don't often mention this, but remind you of their location, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And with that, we'll start off by welcoming Cecil. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. And I hope you're well.
Doing well. Thank you very much. And Wes, good afternoon to you as well. Wes Collins.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So the topic of the for the day?
Lockwood, this afternoon, Wes and I are going to talk about the real estate disclosure form. That is a form that is used during the purchasing process of a house or home or lot or whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
Usually not so much a lot, more of a residence. Relative when a closing is happening, when people are contracting with realtors, there is a disclosure form that has been in existence now for quite some time. We were attempting to determine how long, but Wes is probably correct. It's 10 or 15, maybe even longer than that, years that this form has been around. It was promulgated through the North Carolina Real Estate Commission in consultation with the North Carolina Real Estate Bar Association, the real estate section of the Bar Association. And this is a very important form. And now, of course, interestingly, it's been around long enough, Lockwood, to now have some legal significance, some case law, if you will, some interesting advice that we're about to talk about. And so today we're going to talk about the importance of this real estate disclosure form. And Wes will kind of take us from there.
Wes?
Sure, yeah. A residential property disclosure statement, that's the official name of the document. And, you know, really what it deals with is it's a form document, and you have multiple line items on the document. So if you have property you're selling, and this is not new construction, this would be a property that is not new construction that's being sold, you know, for the first or the second time, or third or fourth or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
Then, and you're dealing with a realtor, then part of the package of documents that the realtor will provide to you by law is a residential property disclosure statement.
Mm-hmm.
And really, even if there's not a realtor involved, a lot of times if you don't, for example, have your seller's agent, the person who is listing and advertising the property for you as your realtor, even the buyer's agent, if they do have an agent, let's say you just have it listed for sale by owner, a buyer's agent would require that document to be signed as well. So it's a document under North Carolina law that is required in these transactions for residential, you know, property. And the purpose of it is to make sure that the buyer knows what he or she is getting.
Right.
Okay? Because really where we start from when we're talking about the purchase of real property is we deal with the, as we mentioned on the program before, the concept of caveat emptor,
mm-hmm.
which is buyer beware. You know, most of us have heard of that before. So, you know, you get what you see, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you're responsible for what you're buying, so you better you know, do your due diligence in looking into what you're buying. However, it's, you know, an issue that you can't always see, you know, issues with the residence.
Right.
Just by walking through it, walking around the outside, so on and so forth. so this residential property disclosure statement enters, and the seller of the property has three options with regard to different line items. The different line items are things like, have you ever had a problem with flooding?
Right.
Have you ever had termite issues? Have you ever had issues with the foundation? Okay, there's probably, I don't know, 20 different line items. And so, and they're broken down into these different areas. And your representations are, yes, I have had a problem. No, I've not had a problem, or no representation.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, you can mark no representation, but that pretty much is going to be a red flag to any buyer to ask questions, mm-hmm. you know, about it. That might scare buyers off. And if you mark yes, you have had an issue, you do have the right to and kind of a place there in the document to explain what the issue may have been.
Mm-hmm.
So be careful about that. I think that's the message to sellers, number one. Don't, I mean, so, you know how these closings go. A lot of times you're in a situation where you've got tons of paper to sign.
Right.
And what the seller normally wants to know is, how much money am I going to end up with after I sell this?
Right.
I mean, that's, we want to look to the bottom right of the settlement statement so we can see how big our check is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, however, but these documents that are being signed are very important. Realtors, most realtors know this. They really pay close attention to it. But sometimes, you know, if there's a little bit of sloppiness with regard to that, you sell the property, and then, you know, you've marked no in a section where it should have been a yes because there was some kind of issue. Even after the buyer buys the property, that relieves that buyer of caveat emptor. That would allow them to then proceed against you as the seller based on a claim of fraud.
Ooh.
Because normally you don't have a claim for breach of contract. Okay, you don't have other types of claims. And the reason why is because the contract says, I pay you X amount of dollars, you receive good title to the property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody's performed at that point once there's a closing, because you wouldn't have gotten title if you didn't pay me the money, and I wouldn't have paid the money unless you were transferring the title. So there's no breach of contract. So the claim that survives is really based on representations. And normally the document we look at is the residential property disclosure statement.
Right.
Now that sounds, it's a little bit complicated, but it doesn't sound, you know, too complicated. Okay, I got it, Mr. Collins. I understand. Be careful about what I represent in that document, because
right.
I know that after the buyer buys the property, if there's something that comes up that I knew about or should have known about, or there's a suggestion that I knew about it, I could find myself on the other side of a fraud lawsuit, which I don't want. So be careful about that. Now, on the other side of the coin, this will lead us to some questions, I'm sure, Lockwood, but on the other side of the coin, the buyer has duties as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Right. Let's say that there are, the residential property disclosure statement has some false statements in it. And let's say that the buyer buys the property, but the buyer does not get a home inspection.
Right.
That's what it doesn't, just doesn't get one at all. Well, if the problems with the property, it could be, you know, water damage, it could be termites, it could be any of the things we've talked about, windows are leaking, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If a home inspection would have disclosed,
right.
would have uncovered these items, and they didn't get one at all, the buyer, then they don't have a claim, because they have a burden of proof in fraud that's affirmative. And what I mean by that is there is an element that they must prove called reasonable reliance. You have to reasonably rely upon the false statements. in the residential property disclosure statement. And as a matter of law, I'm throwing some lingo out there, but what this means is, this is the way it is. If you don't get the home inspected, that home inspection would have uncovered these things that you now have learned about and that you're complaining about and that you're wanting to sell or sue the seller on, then you, as I often say, can't even get off the runway with your lawsuit because you cannot prove reasonable reliance.
Okay. That does lead to a question here, and I just want to remind folks you're listening to Harvell and Collins with Let's Talk Legal, and that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and we were just hearing from Wes Collins a moment ago. Wes, real quickly, the question of reasonable reliance. The concept here then is I may have a house I've checked off and said that did not have a problem with X, Y, and Z.
Sure.
Simply because I was ignorant. I say ignorant. I didn't realize it. I had never had experienced it. Yet the underlying condition was there. And let's just say, for example, never having rain coming from that direction of the house,
sure.
for example.
Yep. Yep.
And suddenly it's discovered because of a storm that there was rain-driven damage, and I did not realize that the circumstances existed. That's the concept of the home inspection, to assure that just because I was ignorant doesn't mean I'm guilty, if you will.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Correct. I would agree with that. We were talking about a fraud. This is a fraud claim.
Good point.
This is the fraud. So, you know, you can't defraud somebody based on something that you don't even know about. But sometimes in these cases, Lockwood, we get into an issue of the plaintiff saying, well, you knew about this. You mm-hmm. said there was no problem with XYZ, and you sold me the property. You took my money, and I gave you the money based on your false representations. And then the response by the defendant, the seller, would be, well, I didn't know anything about that.
Right.
Well, then you get into a factual issue mm-hmm. of there's no way you didn't know about that.
Right.
Okay. So then we get into discovery about things like, you know, termite inspections
mm-hmm.
and, you know, emails and communication.
Uh-huh.
Who provided your termite service? Provide the name of every contractor or every worker that's done any work on the home in the last 6 years. Records get subpoenaed. And then, you know, if you had someone out looking at this problem, then it's probably going to get found out, you know, through discovery. So, you know, it depends on how, and there certainly can be situations where folks have a problem with the property they're selling and they didn't even know it at the time they sold it.
Right.
You know, that's certainly a possibility. Depends on, you know, how extensive the problem is, how bad the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some problems, you know, certainly you wouldn't know about. Some are so obvious. For example, you know, the person moves into the house, they're happy with the house, looks great, man, this is a beautiful house. First decent storm, they have leaks everywhere.
Right.
Well, how did the seller not know about that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you live there 10 years, and we have 20 days after we bought the property, a significant storm, but we have significant storms all the time, and we had 10 leaks. You know, so it's that kind of thing.
We're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about the issue of, real estate disclosure forms, but more than just the disclosure forms, it's the background on this as well. I'm curious, Wes, is there a statute of limitations? I've purchased the property. Is there a point where I have discovered that I think the seller was not totally honest in his disclosure? Is there a statute of limitations beyond which, too bad?
Yeah, it's going to accrue when you knew or should have known. So mm-hmm. it's going to start at that point in time. And it's typically going to be, I like to say 3 years because it's safe.
Right.
But really 4 years. And typically, you know, although there's a stitch, 4 years in the actual fraud statute of limitations, but I like to be safe with 3 years. But normally, these kind of claims, when something pops up, you know, there's a problem with the property, and it's significant enough to, you know, get attorneys involved, then, you know, normally it's going to pop up pretty soon.
Right.
Okay, and normally that's something I would not recommend to sit on for very long, because if, you know, you learn of the problem in the first month, 2-3 months of you owning this property that you purchased, well, if it's important enough to do something about it legally, then, you know, you need to do it relatively quickly. You know, you don't, it wouldn't make any sense to sit around for 3 years and not do anything about
right.
it. So, yes, there is a statute of limitations.
All right.
As far as that goes, but it's upon discovery, though. So that could be, you know, but it wouldn't make sense for you to move into the property and then not discover the problem until years later, you know, because the further you get away from the closing, well, if you didn't learn about it for 2 years, well, how the heck would the seller have known about it?
Well, the other aspect of that is, when did the actual failure occur? Did it occur under my ownership, or 2 years later under your ownership? When did the failure first really occur? So that it's also an issue of timing, is it not?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, there could be a previous owner that had an issue that you never knew about. And there could be evidence that there was a repair. And that's not, you know, just because you had a leak at one point in time doesn't mean that there's an existing problem.
Right.
Because if, you know, if there was a leak, but, you know, you hired a contractor to come in and correct that leak, and there's evidence that it was corrected, and the buyer finds out about that, well, did you find out that there was just a repair of a leak, or did you find that out that there's still an existing leak?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's just a repair, that's fine.
Right.
There's no, that issue's resolved. And the residential property disclosure statement does indicate that.
Okay.
It asks about, like, current infestation of termites and things like that.
All right.
Sometimes houses will have termite issues and they're resolved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been eradicated. So there's a lot of moving parts with regard to that. The other element of this that I do want to touch on, Lockwood, is that our realtors need to be ultra careful in how they represent property.
Ooh.
Okay? And this is another aspect of liability with regard to selling property, even beyond the residential property disclosure statement. What I mean by that is that, you know, normally if you look at listings of property on the MLS, which, you know, just call it an internet search, there's going to be a description of the property.
Mm-hmm.
And the realtors need to be careful that they describe the property accurately. They don't need to make representations regarding the property that's incorrect, that's overly zealous with regard to any aspect of the property, because that liability, meaning that representation that may prove to be false later, could be something that a buyer points to as part of the liabilities, not just the residential property disclosure statement. So, for example, let's say I had a case, you know, one time where a realtor misstated the square footage by like 1,000 square feet.
Whoa!
It was 900 and something, I believe.
Uh huh.
And that was right there in the property description, as it indicated the size of the property. So the buyer, I represented the buyer in that case. The buyer relied upon that when comparing what they were buying, and they were from out of town.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they were from a different state.
Right.
They were relying upon their realtor, their buyer's agent, go from property to property to property, and
mm-hmm.
they were looking at like the size of rooms and, you know, comparing, okay, how much does this cost per square foot? How much does this cost per square foot? And they chose the property based on an understanding that it was X amount of square foot. It was kind of a larger house, so 900 square feet would make a difference, but it would be harder to see the difference
mm-hmm.
in a larger house. So we had to, after we got involved, we had to get you know, actual square footage taken of the house, and it was off like 950 or 20 or something like that.
Right.
And that was really directly as a result of the agent who listed the property just falsely stating the square footage. Now, and there are cases in North Carolina on that reported with the Court of Appeals. I think there might be one Supreme Court case where square footage is a material aspect. Now, mm-hmm. if you're off 10 square feet or 20 or 30 or even close to 100-ish on a larger property, that may not be sufficient to get to it, to a material element that we take into consideration. But where you're talking about 900-odd square feet, that's a biggie. Now, the average buyer who normally is going to be able to walk through the property and see it, so on and so forth, you know, that kind of changes that argument with that kind of case. Because mm-hmm. if you're able to see the property and take your own tape measure and do all that kind of stuff, that's fine. But, you know, we have more and more people who are, you know, relying upon the Internet.
They are.
You know, to examine property and to make their decisions about buying than, you know, we've had in the past.
Right.
So we really rely heavily upon those representations, you know, in the MLS. So realtors just need to be careful with regard to that, because that could certainly extend liability to the realtors themselves and extend liability to their sellers.
Speaking of liability, Wes, and again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about the issue of real estate transactions, and particularly disclosure forms and full disclosure to the seller and the responsibility of the seller for being responsible for doing due diligence. The question I have on the issue of a claim of fraud. Well, I'm sorry. This is this is a case of fraud. What is the penalty? How do you fix the problem, if you will?
Well, damages. Okay. You know, we've got a lot of moving parts with regard to that. You know, we look at the actual damages, they will be okay. It cost, you know, $200,000 to do all of these repairs with regard to all of this water damage in the property that you certainly knew about. Therefore, we want the $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's that, and there's also a punitive. When you have fraud, you also have a punitive damages element that could be up to $250,000 for punishment. So there's that. Now, I talk pretty often, you know, as we talk about damages, the aspect of unfair and deceptive trade practices, okay, and that's kind of a big item of understanding, you know, for attorneys in North Carolina, because if you're able to prove that you have an unfair and deceptive trade act, which normally if you have, you can prove fraud, you can get unfair and deceptive trade practices. That automatically trebles your damages, three times your damages, plus your attorney's fees. Now, there is an exception here with regard to the sale of residential real estate. That is one of the exceptions. If you're a owner of real property, you know, selling your residence, that unfair and deceptive trade practices does not apply to those type of transactions. However, if you're a realtor, a realtor could be subject to unfair and deceptive trade practices, or if the realtor is selling their own property or in the business of, maybe not even a realtor, but someone who is in the business of developing, selling property, just because you're selling the property, you know, as a your own residence, that doesn't mean that unfair and deceptive trade practice does not apply, because you're in the business of doing it. Okay, so you asked a question about damages. Well, most of these transactions are going to be, you know, just owner to owner. There might be a realtor involved, but mm-hmm. if it's just owner to owner, the claim by the buyer against the seller is going to be the damages themselves. That would be what it costs to correct the problem.
Okay.
Number one, plus the possibility of punitive damages that a jury would decide on punishment for making this false representation.
So okay.
That's the way you deal with it. Sometimes we undo the transaction, though. I mean, sometimes we resolve it early by saying, okay, well, you don't like the property? Fine. We'll undo it.
Right.
We'll buy it back. Buy the money back.
Okay. You know, quickly, and Cecil, I hear Cecil about to join us here. The one quick question I have is, you said something a moment ago, a jury trial. So this circumstance ends up in a regular a court trial.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, we try to resolve it. I mean, you know, like any case, I mean, there's normally some communication, unless your back is against the wall on a statute of limitations issue, you need to go ahead and file it.
Uh-huh.
In many cases, there's some back and forth, with regard to trying to resolve it, trying to get to drill down to really what the facts are, what the evidence is going to show to as much as we can before the lawsuit is filed. But it is just a standard lawsuit.
Okay.
A lot of times, Lockwood does lawsuits look like you've got, this is the way that it kind of frames up, you might have the buyer suing the seller and maybe even suing the realtor, and then you might have the seller even filing a cross claim against their realtor, bringing the realtor in because it could be based on the representations that the realtor made.
So
those are, in many cases, that's kind of the how the parties are lined up. Sometimes you might have a termite inspection company,
mm-hmm.
a termite company, treatment company, come in who may have failed in some way.
Right.
So it's that's how the lawsuit oftentimes looks as far as how it's set up with the parties.
Cecil?
Yes, Lockwood. It's been a great program, interesting program, but there are just so many things to be aware of when we purchase property, and you and I and Wes were talking about before we started the recorded show about homeowner associations, restrictive covenants, easements, municipality involvement in a property, condemnation, it's just endless the issues that can arise out of the ownership of real property. I think it would be nice for Wes and I to generate a little list of just cases in our office that it just can be extremely varied. I know we're running out of time, but we recently, Lockwood, even had a case where the buyers bought a home and there were problems and there was this and that and renovation, whatever, and lo and behold, the resolution of that case, after, of course, hiring lawyers, was that the seller just bought the property back.
Right.
In other words, gave the buyers their money back and took the property back. So you were asking earlier how these things get resolved. They can be resolved in hundreds of different ways, but we have a lot of files in our office that touch and concern real estate conflict.
You know, you made a mention there, Cecil, and we probably don't have time to really get into the details on this. We've talked about it in the past, and you mentioned the term easements, and then as we mentioned off air when we started, the concept of covenants. But I'm thinking in relationship to easements, and I'm wondering, is that one of the items that has to be disclosed on this form? And there are instances, I bet, where the transactions of years previous, the current owner may not be aware that there's an existing easement, but is that something that's also noted on this form, or is that done in the real estate search, the property search?
That would be disclosed in the title search.
Title
and
search.
And in reviewing the title note with the title lawyer.
All right.
Yes. Now, there could be, Wes was referring to that, there could be some just obvious issue with the residential property that it would be best for the realtor as well as the seller of the residential property to disclose if there's been some recent utility or easement or sewer situation that has touched and concerned that property, then it might be a good idea for that to be disclosed, and that could potentially be easement related.
Okay, that's a good point. And I can address that on a note that someone who's trying to sell real estate as well. All right, I want to thank our host for the program. That is Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and the topic today being the issue of disclosure forms for real estate. To Cecil, to Wes, thanks very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you.